Hi there, Wendy and I are elated to welcome Parsons' new school designer, Jenny Boucher, originally from Toronto but based in Peru where she is dialing in from. Jenny found herself in the Peruvian Amazon, having traveled for a Peru and Canada bilateral design project, through which she met her now husband and business partner, award-winning Peruvian industrial designer, Mauricio Navarro. Together, they explore the intersection between local identity and contemporary Peruvian craft and textile and stone through their brand and business, Dad Proyectos. Dad stands for Desarrollo Artesanal Rentable, which translates to Sustainable Artisan Development Project. They're believers in that mindful design can act as a bridge between indigenous craft communities and global citizens. Wendy and I were lucky to unbox their iconic products. We fell in love with these products that embody a day in hands and the art of play. Featured in New York Times Style Magazine, House and Home Magazine, and The Cut, their beautiful iconic products can be found in MoMA design stores as well as other museum stores and boutiques in Japan, France, Denmark, Korea, and throughout the globe. We're honored to share Jenny's inspiring adventure on building Dar Proyectos and what that has meant for her as a new mother and leader in our world. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Norma.
I am so excited about this episode. We're actually going to do a little collage for this full episode, but we're going to start off with this piece. We recently connected with a beautiful brand online who reached out to us. They stumbled upon our podcast and we were honored. They're out of Pacasmayo, Peru. They're Andean gemstone objects, and the brand is Dar Proyectos.
Yes. And when you sent the link to me, you were like, oh my God, these people just reached out to us. I was like, okay, so cool. Because, and you were like, this is really awesome. And I popped on the website and I was like, oh yeah, this is beautiful. This is the idea is that we're creating objects with intention, that they're beautiful, functional, and can become everyday objects in our lives. So I think that them reaching us is the exact right answer for what we've been asking for of the universe, right?
Yes. And when you said lives, it's also livelihoods. It made me super happy to discover them through this podcast, which I think has been a beautiful serendipity moment. But then learning about their story, which we'll learn more about directly from them, which I'm so honored that they're willing to dial in from Peru in a couple of weeks. We're actually going to pull this whole podcast together, so you'll be hearing it real time. But this conversation is the first step of us, again, serendipitously, we're talking about scheduling and the timing, and then we get a knock on the front door.
It was so
and
crazy.
This box is delivered from Peru.
Our third podcast member, Matisse, was like, wait, you guys, there's something important at the door.
My dog, yes. Let me interrupt your very important conversation. And so I went to the door and there's this beautiful, I say beautiful because it's tattered and you can tell this box came from a long way.
It
and
traveled.
It says fragile and it's tattered. And I thought, ooh, and I look and I see the name and I see it's from Peru and my heart just fluttered. I'm so excited to open this. So when we say unboxing, this is our first real unboxing.
A real unboxing episode.
We got our scissors, we opened the box and we have three boxes sitting in front of us. Wendy got stone game. So we'll let you go first, Wendy.
Sure. So when we were approached and trying out these products, let us know, like, peruse the website.
Peruse from Peru.
I said it and I was like, oh, dang. That's a pun waiting to happen. So I chose something that I could do with Izzy.
I love that.
So I was searching and I found the stone games and this box is beautifully designed. It's cardboard. It doesn't have any plastic, which I really appreciate. It's colorful, but not atrocious or in your face. It's neutral, but still very graphic and fun. So it says Stone Games, and I open up the box. Oh, I'm just going to read this. Oh, gosh. If you're reading this message, it's probably because you enjoy the concept of, and beauty of this everyday object. Good news. There is more behind each piece than meets the eye. Your choice helps enable a community of talented craftsmen to preserve their ancient traditions. Carved skillfully by artisans from Peru, these rocking gems are literally a slice of the Andean magic shared with you. I'm very into sustainable packaging. It's really important to consider all of the parts. Then there's the board and all of the pieces. It says, pieces are hand-carved of semi-precious Andean stones made in Pacasmayo, Peru. Okay.
Obviously, this is a very visual process and you're listening in, but if you go to our Instagram, you could see snippets of the product. This is stunning and it's sculpture. It's a tic-tac-toe game, but it looks like a sculpture.
Yeah. And that's why I really wanted it, because I think that it's a basic piece that will last a lifetime. And I can give this to Izzy to have when he plays tic-tac-toe with his kids. And Izzy's 5, right? So like, he's going to have this as part of our experience, but then also an experience he can share with his friends. There's nothing about this that is going to be destroyed. This is real rock. Yeah. It's beautiful.
And the colors.
Yes.
Neutral. Like, you'd want this in your home. Like,
absolutely. This goes on a table and you can play it anytime. And it's a conversation piece.
Yeah.
You can just be
present
and play.
I love it.
And that playfulness is really what we want in life.
Yes. Right? And play also brings us together.
Yes.
Emotionally, without us knowing it, you show up to win or compete. Yeah. But at the end of the day, we end up being closer together.
Yes, absolutely.
That's what I experienced at your birthday when we decided to play pool randomly. Oh, yeah. And we split up into two groups. And Wendy is on the loser group with me. We are not winning. And she...
I'm like, I'm going to be on my team basically with my bestie, Norma, and we're going to dominate. It was me, Norma, and Andrea, and we were losing. And it's my birthday, and I'm like, I'm not interested in losing. I'm not.
You aren't. She, first of all, I'm never flat interested. Out, as soon as we lost, she went over to her other really good friend, Nicole, said, can I join your team?
Can I be on your team? Can we do a swippy swappy?
She left us, and then we proceeded to lose, I think, 3 more games.
Yeah, who went to your team, though? Anyways, someone else.
It doesn't matter, but that brought out true colors. Right. Like, people were like, oh, no, you are going down, and... It just brought out so many layers of personality that I loved.
And then you guys
ended up winning. Then we won. And then Nicole goes, the losers won. Thanks. Thanks, Nicole. Anyway, but yes, but play.
Play is the relationship between what we need to do and what we get to do, right?
Yes.
So I'm excited to spend time with Izzy doing this. It's beautiful. And I feel very grateful and honored that I get to have this piece in my home. And it's small. I have a tiny little cottage, so it's not going to take
everything
too much
has intention. Like anything that comes into your home, I've noticed, has meaning. It's everything that we talk about here. Yes. You're not going to bring something in your home without true intention and meaning.
And I did spend some time thinking about what it was that I was going to request. So I'm very pleased with my unbox. I had no idea what the dimensions of this game would be, but this is the perfect size.
I love it. Okay, so my turn to do my unboxing. I love that you went with play and something you can do with Izzy. I also picked something that I could do with my son, but I went into more of the kitchen space. So lately, thanks to you, we've been trying meal kits and we've been cooking together, teaching him about ingredients and sharing that. So I love the idea of tabletops. There is a puzzle piece that I fell in love with that interlocks. So it's a 2 puzzle pieces that are essentially turn into a cutting board. Actually, talking about the box, everything that Wendy said is true. Cardboard, recyclable, beautifully designed in terms of graphics and colors and simplicity and typography. The first thing you said is that it reminds you of Matisse, which is what my dog's name is, but it's so just elegant, sustainable. As I open the stone, it's a banded onyx grima. Banded onyx is a striking quartz-based mineral displaying patterns ranging from white to honey to coffee. It is formed in the Andes of Arequipa in Peru. This stone is associated with grounding energy, vitality, and motivation, a stone of regeneration. Onyx is invigorating when used on the feet, promoting a connection with the root chakra, which you know a lot about, Wendy. Mm-hmm. Believed to improve the function of the nervous system and sensory organs.
I think that's really beautiful that they put all of that information into the packaging, because it allows you to connect deeper.
And meet you where you are, because I think sometimes you're not able to receive it, sometimes you are. So, okay, I'm unboxing, taking the wrapping off. Oh my gosh, this is a lot bigger than I anticipated in terms of scale. This is beautiful. So it looks like a simple puzzle piece. And as I get to the second one, I think it'll be interlocking. Let me see. Oh, the second one is actually wood. So the second cutting board is an interlocking piece, but this one is wood. So you get the mix of materialities. And the scale, as I said, It's a lot bigger than I imagined from the photographs, which I love. There's going to be a presence, but I think it could be a great charcuterie board presentation, or like Wendy's piece, it could be decor because it's really beautiful in scale and color. What do you think?
I love it. I think that it's beautiful. It's grounding. I like the way that the colors of the wood speak to the colors of the stone.
Thank you to Jenny and Mauricio. We're so excited to have them on. So we have to wait a little bit, but for you, you're going to get to hear their story right after this.
So good. So good. I can't wait.
Yeah. Hi, Jenny. We are so excited to have you on our Transactional Love podcast, welcoming you from Peru. We are not sitting here together, but thank you to technology, we're able to pretend like we're together and have a conversation.
It's just a different hemisphere.
So it's the opposite season. Yeah, right. Okay. Okay.
It's really hot. It's very hot and sweaty as opposed to cold, although you're in California. So
not cold. I still have a sweater on.
Jenny, to just dive into you and your journey, if someone didn't have access to your social media and your website and your beautiful products, how would you describe to them for the first time what it is and what you do?
Sure. I run a design studio and social enterprise. It's called Dar Proyectos. It's based in Peru, and we live in a really rural northern part of Peru. And I do this with my Peruvian husband, who was not my husband when I first met him. We first met on a design project, but we run this business together. And we produce two different lines of product. One are colorful, semi-precious gemstone objects that are often for play or decor, but everything always has a bit of a playful element to it, even if it's just a decor piece. And then we also run a line of crochet and textile products, and that often is private labels. It's a very different business for us than the brand that we run, which is the stone product. And we focus on using traditional techniques and reinvigorating different cultural traditions that otherwise might vanish, and instead try to breathe new life into these types of cultural gems.
And I have to say, while Wendy and I were recording for a different podcast, we got a knock on the door and we got a FedEx box from Peru, and we were so excited to open. So we were so fortunate to have two of your products to really feel and understand prior to speaking with you. And I have to say that the craftsmanship, the beauty, the storytelling of receiving the product itself and the philosophies behind it, I thought was just such a great experience for us to have prior to even having this conversation with you. So I feel very fortunate to be able to connect, even though we're not in person, we're able to touch your beautiful artisanship.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I requested the tic-tac-toe set. Yes. And the whole unboxing experience was really thoughtful. And I appreciate story in the packaging just as much as the actual product itself. Understanding that the box is telling part of the story, the thoughtfulness that you put into designing not just the items that you make, but also the experience that gets delivered. I think that's just exactly.
It's so true.
Yeah. It's so thoughtful. And then I took the game with Norma and my son to a wine tasting because we're those kinds of parents. And Izzy, he's five. He's never played tic-tac-toe before. And I opened it up.
Oh, yeah.
I showed him how, and he kicked my butt in like the second round. Set it up so I couldn't win. And I was like, dang it. But it was such
That's a good thing, though.
It really is. And it was such a fun experience. And he already started winning and building confidence in it. So seeing him unfold a little bit in that experience together with something that's so durable and so beautiful, it will stay out. It's a game that he can just bring to me at any time. Instead of being like, Mom, can we go to the game closet and get out trouble or sorry? It's like, this one sits out, right?
And it's a beautiful sculpture. It's art, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the vision, is that when it's not in use, it's a beautiful sculptural thing of these gemstones that we're so used to seeing gemstones and jewelry, and kind of that's it. Or you tend to have, like, in meditation, maybe a little rock, but we really love adding the design element to these really precious, semi-precious materials that we don't normally get to just play around with. And we also have a 3-year-old, and it's very hard to keep our stones off limits, you can imagine. Our house is full of samples and games and stones. And it's surprising how little kids obviously gravitate to things like this. We all naturally do. But then, like, kids learn, I think, also from a young age to treat things with care and respect. And I think that's a nice element, too.
And it's so funny because I didn't realize this when Wendy and I were looking to see what would we be excited about. We were both thinking about our children. And I also have a 3-year-old. And without knowing, we both were thinking about how do we share this piece with them. So for me, I had the puzzle piece serving tray that came in two different beautiful materials. One was the onyx crema, Andean stone, and then the other piece was the Andean cachimbo wood. And my 3-year-old is learning how to cook with me. We've been doing that so much lately, and he's loving learning about ingredients and touching the ingredients. So for me, the tabletop piece felt like that's something that we could share. He could serve with it. And I think you're absolutely right. It's not these precious materials can't be kept off limits. Like, we have to share them in a way that they can learn to respect and understand the weight of beautiful craftsmanship. And how do you do that from an early age? So I thank you for giving us the opportunity to share that with our children. And I feel like now it's going to be a piece that they'll keep, right, for their generations.
Yeah. And I also think it's kind of like this farm to table experience, where the whole point of that movement is to connect people back to the earth. And I think that's what your products also do, is they connect us on a deeper level to the natural beauty around us, and being able to introduce that to our children at an early age and just make it an intrinsic part of the language that they speak is a gift in and of itself.
Yeah, even for grownups and for kids and grownups, the things that we have around us in our spaces are part of our lives. And they help us. They can help or hinder us. They can help us slow down and breathe a little bit and do something a little meditative and mindful. And
absolutely,
you know, just our energies and these stones, there's a lot of layers to it that we love to play with.
Yeah, and I think with the tactile piece, because with their textiles and your stones, to me, like, now with technology and the digital age just being so prevalent, how do we stay tactile? Mm-hmm. To me, is an interesting conversation. So let's dive into you, because you've had a global journey. You started in New York, you're from Canada, but tell us a little bit about that journey. What brought you to Peru? But maybe even back up a little bit more in your childhood. Where did you grow up? How did that inform your different forks in the road that you've taken?
Sure. Yeah, I have had a few forks. I haven't exactly had I was not one of those kids that grew up, I'm going to be something. It's always been something like this. I don't know. But yeah, from the beginning, I'm from Toronto, or Canada, and I come from a family of makers through and through, for sure. My father was a carpenter and worked with wood always. He did programming and making things. And my mom's side of the family were dressmakers for generations and generations in the capital of Canada, in Ottawa. And so I always grew up making things and being exposed to materials and trying again, and there's no wrong answer, exploring. So that's inherently in my blood, and that's definitely my happy place. Even today, if I'm feeling stressed and I sit down at a sewing machine, I am, everything changes. Going to high school and going to university from there, for my parents, going to fashion design school was a hard no right out the door. Mm.
Is that something that you were inspired by watching your mom, or what drew you to fashion?
I think the textile layer of things, the tactile ways that we can tell stories and that we have told stories over time, has just been something that's always fascinated me. I studied in university something normal, let's say, which was this degree called Media Information and Techniculture, which is a made-up word and a very odd title for a degree, but it's somewhere between media and cultural theory, politics, like a little bit of everything. So back then, this was early 2000s, I wrote my thesis on social infrastructure and AI in the future. Oh. Now here today,
and very ahead of
to
your
think
time.
About, but it was very, I haven't really even dived down that path since then, but it was a real mind-opening type of career path. Most of my friends did things like marketing and publicity, and they're geniuses, but that was just never what I cared about in the same way. I saved up all my money after university, and I traveled the world, and all kinds of textiles. I went back over and over to cultural institutions and textiles, and I was just always fascinated and drawn to that. And so by the time I got back, I was like, you know what, the only thing I care about that I would want to invest all my energy in would be something in fashion or textiles.
Can you touch a little bit on some of the countries that maybe shaped those aha moments of, because when you say travel the world, I'm sure that teaches you so much about cultures and resources, but what were the kind of the stops along the way?
Sure. There's a million places I still have on my list, but at that moment I went through East Asia and spent a lot of time in Thailand and Laos, where there are just beautiful textiles and rich color. But I also went through Eastern Europe, and I remember seeing in, I want to say, Serbia, really crazy histories that have been so complicated and but are so honored in the textile traditions that exist there. And I remember distinctly seeing certain textiles there that just really caught my inspiration from that point. And then since now living in Peru, Peru is blew my mind when I came here, but I hadn't done that at that point.
I have to ask a little bit of you just being that girl, saving your money, deciding to travel the world. I'm sure a lot of that was on your own. Break that down because to me is so courageous and amazing and beautiful. And gosh, what were you thinking?
I always really wanted to travel and I didn't have the money to do it. So I finished school and worked my tail off for almost a year and then took off. And at first I went with my boyfriend at the time, but then I was like, no, I also want to do all these other things and you don't want to do it. So ciao. And so we went on our own journeys and I went through some of Europe and met some friends here and there and went by myself here and there because I really wanted to see more of the world. I wanted the chance to understand different points of view and different cultures and everything. Why not? And I figure if I don't do this now, when else will I have that freedom to meander? And when you have a family, it's not the same to do a trip like that, right?
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. I think the thing that I keep hearing, maybe it's Odysseus, I'm going to get it all screwed up, but there's this woman who weaves every night. And the whole point is that when she gets to the end of the weaving, that she has to marry this man who has been trying to court her.
Wow.
Do you know this story at all?
No, I don't believe so.
So she weaves every day, all day, and she's at this loom, and this man who she doesn't want to marry, because I believe it's Odysseus who's out on this journey, and she's pining away for him, and he was sent on this journey by this man who's trying to marry this woman. And she's, okay, so every day I will weave, and when I get to the end of this tapestry, if Odysseus hasn't returned, I will marry you. And so she weaves all day, and at the end of every night, when everybody goes to sleep, she unweaves
it. Yeah. Yes.
So that way she doesn't have to marry this man. And he's like, over the course of the story, we're following Odysseus go on all of these crazy adventures. And it sounds like you are Odysseus in this story, but someone else was like holding a weaving for you.
But interesting. There's
this way in which you are already weaving a story for yourself that you haven't really found yet.
That's such a nice way to frame it all because, it definitely wasn't something where I was like, oh, here's the journey. But meanwhile, the whole thing has been a journey. It's funny because I remember speaking with a friend not that long ago and I was like, how did I end up in this situation with life in Peru? Because that's exactly what you always wanted to do. What are you talking about?
Yes.
This is exactly what you've always wanted to do. And I was like, oh, you're right. It is. I know. And I don't think I even quite like framed it in my head that way, but it's just come to be a sum of all these parts.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really amazing. And I can't wait to hear how you got from your world travels to landing. I assume back in Canada, right. Is that correct? Did you go home?
So I did. I came back to Canada. I applied to Parsons and I thought, oh, that's a long shot. Let's try. If I'm going to do fashion design, let's just try to go big. And I got in and thanks to the support of my family, I was able to do that. And it was living in New York was just such a dream. I had never even been to New York, but I packed up all my stuff and I went and I studied fashion design and I was able to do some internships there with a trend forecasting organization called WGSN and a textile artist I was really inspired with. I ended up moving back to Toronto after that. My father passed away and it was really time where I needed to be home. And it was a very different world when you finish school, you're starting. But find my way forward. New York has a huge fashion industry. Toronto is different. But I ended up working in product development with a really great company in Toronto and working on a bunch of freelance things after that and all kinds of things until eventually I was working with this organization who was in partnership with the Peruvian government. And it was a really like long shot that I ended up coming to Peru, but I was a junior designer helping one freelance project do the design steps, so the design, technical design, tech packs all kinds of stuff. And the director and the lead designer were supposed to go to Peru, and at the last minute the director couldn't go, and I had been the whole time saying, if you need a lead person, I can go. If you want, I'll go. Just let me know anytime. Yeah. Oh. And they're like, yeah, shut up, Jenny. And in the last moment they're like, okay, go. You're going.
Yeah, we're tagging you in, Jenny. Do you speak Spanish?
Right? And it changed my life. I did not speak a word of Spanish that first trip that I went on, but now I do, yes.
Right. Yeah, I'm always curious because I feel like I would be really afraid to go a place and not be able to speak the language well and get through
it. It's hard to not. Yeah. It wasn't easy for sure at first. I first came here working on this design project that was between the governments, and my partner, Mauricio, was on the Peruvian design team, and I was on the Canadian design team. And so all these Peruvians spoke English, but I did not speak Spanish at all. And we went around and got to see all these incredible communities of artisans in Peru, and it just absolutely blew my mind, the traditions and the techniques and the materials here. And yeah, and from there, my husband and I, we each went back to our respective countries, but we ended up chatting on Skype at the time, almost increasingly more and more every day until it became obvious that there was something beyond doing the design work.
You were talking about how your mind was blown by the way that they create the textiles and the different techniques that they use. What was it that was so unique and special that you hadn't seen before in all of your other travels? Gosh.
Okay. The first place that we went when we landed here was to the jungle, to a place called Pucallpa. And we worked with this community called Shipibo. And Mauricio had also, like, of all the different designers in Peru, each one was assigned to a region. He had fought to be on that region. We had never met before. So we met there in this place called Pucallpa.
And we met in the middle of the jungle. I love this story so
we
much.
We met in the jungle, yeah. Yes. And it was not like Tarzan at first sight, I will say, but it has evolved. But honestly, okay, I'll tell you as well. So this community of Shipibo, it is absolutely incredible. There is a very rich oral tradition where patterns are sung and painted onto fabric and ceramics and all kinds and paintings. And so people can be sitting, not looking at each other and singing a song, and they will paint the same thing.
Wow.
And I've never heard of anything like this. And the artwork, there are these intricate, wonderful geometric patterns that look like weaving snakes through fabric. They're just incredible, really beautiful, besides the fact that they have this incredible methodology of working. And so traditionally the shaman would take an ayahuasca treatment and sing these messages from the underworld, and they would be shared with the community through these methodologies of textile and ceramic and art. Wow. So just absolutely incredible. And Mauricio was so passionate about it and had read about it. And I was like, oh my God, who is this man as well? Like, what? So it was, a very interesting time in my life.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear how you've had all those travels, and then this was the first time where the melody piece, the different sense that is bigger than the visual, came to life. And to me, there's something about Andean culture that I'm just learning about it. There's a Latin American market called La Cosecha in Washington, D.C. So I've learned through the Peruvian retailers there how this precious practice of the textiles and the stones and these natural resources and then them being crafted are indigenous craft that is getting lost as generations. The children of these indigenous families aren't taking that on as they move on to take on other careers or trades. So talk a little bit about the preciousness of these practices and how this is also an effort to save these practices and artisanship.
Yeah, absolutely. For us, in running our business on the day-to-day, we confront these issues because the traditional techniques that we work with, which are so interesting and unique and have provided us with design solutions that we don't see from other methods. And I've worked in many different layers of design, and there's so many techniques here that I haven't seen that are so interesting to explore. And yet they are a low priority for so many communities and families. And it has been one of our biggest challenges is that in order to create sufficient, reliable work for the artisan teams that we work with, we have to guarantee a certain amount of work so that they can rely on it. Because if they don't have reliable work in craft, then they can't train young people and they can't manage their bills. They have to split off and go into other things, like driving a moto taxi is more economical for some than training their son to learn a craft. And that's so sad. That's tragic. We try to breathe design, life, and ideas into the techniques that we encounter here so that we can give them new pathways forward, not necessarily the same presentation that it was before, maybe, but add an element of, oh, what if we try this other material that you never would have thought of before? Try to innovate in some way to give a fresh view on the technique itself.
Right. It's almost like the culture and practice is an endangered species. Exactly. And so being able to create an environment that endangered culture or craft in this case can continue to survive, you have to create a world around it that supports it. And that's what you are doing instead of creating the habitat in which an animal can survive and be protected. You're creating a habitat for this cultural connection, not only to the earth, but also to these traditions. It's just so beautiful hearing about the shaman who brings messages forth as wisdom for the community. And they weave that wisdom for future generations, and having that connection to the other realms be lost because it's not marketable. It's like bananas. Well, and
you know what? The biggest issue that we first encountered, we were working on this intergovernmental design project, and government projects have a start and an end date, and they have a set of deliverables, and you try to accomplish in the time frame, and if you don't, everybody moves forward, and there's a new government, and we move on. And we were really frustrated with that experience because we made this big design initiative and created all kinds of great things. And then what? There wasn't a budget for production training. There wasn't a budget for entrepreneurship or how to organize a group of artisans to work together and formally to do things on time, to do things consistently. None of that was put in place. And so we lobbied the government to add another component to the project because we were just like, this is ridiculous. You can't just leave it here. You have to keep going. And they did. And that was great. But what we really took away from that was that we could do something, in our view, better, that have a longer term vision. We could really look at where we believe this could go and build it out. And that's not something that just happened overnight. I remember at first going to see these communities and we would like, okay, here's some work. And Here's a new design. We're going to train how to do it. Then we're going to follow through on the production. And every time we would finish a production, they would say, please come back, and not really trust that we would. Yeah. And it took years of building trust. They are relatively disenfranchised communities that haven't really had anyone like looking out for them. The social institutions here are not really there for them. And to have someone invested in them, they're like, yeah, sure. Who? So it took us time to build that.
Yeah. And I also got this nugget that with the artisanship, with the craft, with the materials, there's also an element of dialect in the language. And to me, storytelling bridges generations together, right? And I think not only are these practices precious and going extinct, like Wendy said, but I think the language dying with that, the indigenous dialects and the languages that are paired with these communities also dying because they're not being invested in and cultivated, to me, is so tragic that those stories can't be continued and told. And I do want to hit on that. You just said a lot that I think is so important, because I think there is a lot of importing of foreign product, craft, work, labor, etc. into the U.S. And I think what you just said in doing all of those things, but in a respectful way, remaining invested in these communities in a way that isn't taking advantage of, but also cultivating back into and feeding into that infrastructure, whether it's investing in that community financially or knowledge-wise or mentorship-wise. I'd love to hear a little bit about taking your experience from design school and Toronto in your roles. How have you taught these communities how to create an entrepreneurial business structure to build access, and hit on some of those business strategies? Because I think that's so important as we start to look at foreign investment in a very responsible way.
Yeah, absolutely. I could say that design school doesn't teach you anything about any of that, like at all. like design school, I learned how to construct things beautifully and create mood boards and et cetera. But you don't learn about production, first of all, which is the core of a fashion design company. You don't learn about business either. Those are all things that we've really learned along the way. When we first started our own business here, I had a client approach me and say, oh, can you make 500 crochet bags? And I was like, yes. And then we figured out how to do it. And part of it was the design. Here's how we interpret the design so that artisans understand. One thing is you have someone having an idea, but when you have an illiterate population, not entirely illiterate, but several people who are, or who are not used to reading a spec sheet, you have to transform the information so that it's digestible and relatable. There are still people who measure in thumb lengths and finger lengths. Oh yeah, about this looks good. Mind you, my hand is bigger than someone else's. But you have to build the language of design with people, which is a more common language in some ways than like English and Spanish. But then over time, we've also had to look at, okay, we are designers and we are not able to, nor is that the goal, is to micromanage individually. We worked with 300 women at the beginning in textiles. And so the goal was then to build infrastructures and hierarchies of communities and a network of these communities so that everyone's working together. Mm-hmm. And that really took a lot of time because we didn't have a roadmap. We were figuring it out as we went. And so we had to develop, okay, who's attending, who's going to take the training class, who's getting marks on their consistency and quality, and create this way that they could monitor themselves and be responsible for themselves and do their invoicing and do even financial literacy training, all kinds of things. It's really evolved over the years. But without that involvement, creating infrastructure so that they could run their own business, this would not exist.
Yeah, it's a balancing act. So on one hand, you're creating a world where they can maintain these crafts and legacies of their culture that have been handed down for mm-hmm. generations and generations. And on the other hand, you're creating a world that they can bring those things to market in a meaningful way so that that mother of a son who's considering being the driver instead of the weaver, mm-hmm. right? That they can say, actually, this is, there's a glimmer here. There's still hope for us to create a world that supports us if we have these tools that engage with the world that's building up around us.
Exactly. It can be very romantic to say, oh, we're going to preserve craft.
Right.
Sure. That sounds wonderful. And museums do that, but that doesn't bring reliable work to people. That doesn't guarantee economic safety. A lot of the communities we work with are in poverty, or in some cases there are some communities in extreme poverty. Their biggest priority is that they can take care of their children, that they have enough money to buy the food and take care of their very basic needs, suggesting that they need to drop everything and do training, or that they need to attend work even. Like mothers with many children cannot go to work, and but we've built a system so that moms can work from home and they attend brief meetings weekly to see how to do the product, to check on the consistency quality. But we've had to build infrastructure that allows people to do this so that it really serves them, because otherwise it's just a conceptual, it's just an idea.
Yeah, here in the States, the way we work is that the worker serves the company, not the company serves the mm-hmm. worker. And what you're saying is just
the opposite.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, our goal was never to own all of these workshops. We always wanted to delegate, that artisan teams are created and they can manage themselves, and we can interact and we can enable them. And a lot of our time of our team is dedicated to maintaining the invoicing clear and being transparent, because there's a lot of informality here in Peru. A lot mm-hmm. of people don't pay into their taxes because what does the government do for you? Maybe that's a little political to say, but complicated. Yeah.
So there's two questions I have, and they're very separate. So take them in whatever order you like. The first is that when we got our products, they were stunningly beautiful, and learning about the materials themselves felt extremely indicative of Peruvian culture and the earth there and craftsmanship there. But it also felt not traditional, right? It was a representation that was very modern and even avant-garde. I would argue to say that it didn't feel like something you would expect from traditional Peruvian artisanship. So talk a little bit about how mm-hmm. your design expertise is probably guiding the presentation of the craft and these products themselves to make them appealing to this modern society, modern culture that we're living in. And how much have you taken that under your wing? Because I would argue that with all of these artisans, you're probably guiding them and saying, let me share what I've learned through my design experience and my design career. What has that conversation been like?
Yeah, that's a great question. Always, it's essential for us to first listen to their capacities, because if I come in with an idea that's just completely unrealistic and beyond, they're just going to look at me and say, okay, and then I might think that it's happening. But it is so important to us that we really listen and explore what they can do within the realm of what we want to achieve, because what we're trying to do is offer something that different. In maybe the 80s, there was a huge industry in Peru of stone carving little sculptures. And then China also started doing that, and Peru does not compete. And so a lot of these workshops have just declined steadily since then. And so our goal, and Mauricio has been working on this since even before I met him, is working with communities to give, breathe new life again into these traditions. And we've explored a lot of, yeah, more contemporary designs, more iconic things that maybe you've seen before, like the laundry clip that we do, you've seen it a billion times, but we've elevated it in this gemstone material, or these games that are classics, that are meant to be classics as well in our iteration of them, that are classic things, but they feel contemporary because you don't usually see gemstones in these sharp graphic manners of presentation. So for us, it's a challenge because people aren't necessarily looking for these categories of gemstone games. It's not something that is necessarily like
Google.
Right.
That's not a Google search.
Right? that's our challenge point, because we know we can't compete with China and we don't want to. And we want to create something different, and we want to create something that, as designers, that inspires us and makes us feel like we're doing something and creating something worthwhile in the world. But yeah, how to market that in the right way is constantly our evolving journey.
And the second part of that question is, would you identify yourself as the network of these artisans? For someone 100% familiar with Dar Proyectos, would you say that you're the curator of this collection of artisans and communities, and then the conduit to make them accessible around the world? Or how would you describe your infrastructure and relationship with these artisans?
We have the two lines of the business. On the stone side, we have our own designs, and we come to different artisan groups and say, we want to do this. What can you do? Can you do something like this? And there's a lot of back and forth, but it's usually our designs that we come with, and then we purchase products from them, and we work with them a lot on the transparency, traceability of their infrastructure. But it's them. They're producing a product like any kind of tertiary producer. On the textiles, we do much more product development. So there we do a lot of design with the team, wherever they may be in the world, whether it's the US or London or wherever. And so we'll often, it depends on the designer, but sometimes they'll send us something really worked out or something that's just a quick sketch, and we'll work out how to translate that into this design language that our artisan team now knows well how to work with. Like, we spec out every stitch in most cases so that it's really easy to interpret and weave. And then we purchase those. And so those are a secure purchase. The artisan knows you are ordering, you are requesting this. In the case of the textiles, we provide the materials because we want to control as well the quality. And we have some exclusive materials that we make as well. And then they give us the product and they get paid. And it's clean and simple, as opposed to they also have their own line that they've now, our artisan group of textiles, they've recently launched their association and they have their own line of product, but it's not like they make them all the same. Everyone makes their own thing and then they put them all together for a market. They have their own business and we don't compete with them. We have our own business that we come to them with.
I love this. And it's a collage, right, of partnership and relationship nurturing and your own creations. It reminds me a lot of Chalverian in a way.
And I think what's nice about that is that all of those different arms of the business probably support and enhance each other, even if they are separate. We're creating a conversation around what it means to be truly supportive and revitalize a community that needs to see a glimmer. I just keep going back to this glimmer idea that what they have is important just as much as driving a car is, that it's just as magical or useful in the world, even if it's not been what they've been asked for by the world. We still need and want this. We just have to figure out a way to say, hey, world, look over here at this really beautiful, magical moment. Accept it. Be inspired by it, too, because we're crazy about it. There's something in that passion that you and Mauricio have that I want to dig a little bit more into.
Yeah, I think I would have probably say when we first launched our business, we started working with a brand called Sophie Anderson, who came asking for 500 like beautiful handmade crochet bags. It opened my eyes that yes, we could. And even if we don't have it all sorted out, we can figure it out. I don't know. There was something. Mauricio's very capable at, he's an excellent designer and he's very creative, but he's also has a real way with people, how to pull people together to work together and that we're not competing one against the another. We don't need to control the workshops. We need to enable. Yeah. We don't need to have ownership. We need to buy and sell and then allow it to move forward. At that moment, we sat down and mapped out how can we move forward in Peru and find the right materials and then find the communities. And in that moment, Mauricio was like, well, you know what? I might know this one and then another. I think both of us have been just determined to make it happen. Even like we've moved to Pacasmayo, which is not close to either of our families, but it's a very special place at the edge of the ocean. Mm. We're close to the communities that we work with and we're able to just create things. And it feels so rewarding to be able to do as opposed to like remote control, like being helping from afar. It's not the same.
What has it been like with your child now?
Yeah, I was thinking about that journey too.
Because was your child born in Peru?
No. She's a real pandemic child.
Yeah, we got one of those. So you get it.
I got one of those.
Yeah. She was born in December of the 2020. We were in Peru in Pacasmayo during the pandemic. And just in October, she was born in December, but in late October, they opened up the international flights. And it was also the same time, the limit you're allowed to travel when you're pregnant. And I just desperately wanted to be with my family at that point. Yeah, and I had never had a child before. And I had also, a lot had happened in the world. And so we were able to slip home. And so she was born in Toronto. Otherwise, we're here a lot. And it's been such a journey. I don't know. She's a little bilingual human. My business was my child. And now my child is my child. And my business is definitely second fiddle, but it's not. It's still just as important. And so finding the balance is definitely a challenge sometimes, but it works. Like we're traveling a bit less and trying to spend longer times anytime we go somewhere so that we are really digging into where we are, both to see our family and our friends and our world, but also to enable the space to work and to do the things we need to do.
In thinking about your work, so you started your business prior to having your baby. How did motherhood change your perspective on being this brand's founder, especially with Mauricio as your partner? How did that shift coming out of the pandemic and early motherhood? What was your lens, if anything?
Yeah, I don't have much to compare it to because it's been my only experience of motherhood. The pandemic was such an experience of there's little control you have over some bigger things in the world around us. And motherhood also. A friend of mine gave me the advice of it. Motherhood is a practice of letting go of expectations. And I felt that was very fitting as through the pandemic, we were going through this pregnancy. The business is now my teenager because it's growing up. And it has a whole other world of challenges.
Yeah.
When we were first with Renata in a factory, once visiting a supplier, she was like, my child, Renata, she was maybe a year old. And we remember the owner was like, oh, how's it going? I bet you guys are keeping you up at night, isn't she? Bet you're not sleeping that well. Like, yeah. Oof. Rough. And he's like, wait till she's 18. You know, so that the keys to your car, just wait. And we were like, oh God, you're right. And our business is now in a phase of growth where it's really important to us that we scale up so that this whole thing that we've built is maintained, but has to find this balance that is sustainable for us so that as we invest in reliable work with the workshop, we also then have to sell more and guarantee that we sell more. And it's a journey, but definitely a teenager now.
It sounds like Mauricio is a weaver and he's like a spider in a way where his like web is how he connects. Spiders are the master weavers. I love this whole metaphor, obviously.
Weaving.
I'm like really into it. I'm going to keep going on it. But I think that's really what's beautiful is that you can drop a stitch here or there and pick up another row. That's what's really cool about being your own boss and striking out on your own path and journey. Nobody's, hey, is there a roadmap for being an entrepreneur in a foreign country and then have a child?
Right. Throw a pandemic on top.
Right. By the way, yeah. Pandemic.
But you know what? The views are great. So.
It was great, actually. It was in some ways idyllic here, like everything's shut down and we're at the beach.
I can imagine.
What in that journey, was there a hardship or a failure as you're building and scaling your business that you had to reassess and ask yourself, is this the right path that we're taking? Did you ever question through hardship or challenges? And what advice would you give yourself at that time? Because you've obviously continued through that and have been resilient. Because to us, this is what's so good about the entrepreneurship journey. It's not pretty and hard.
It's the messy middle. The middle is the whole thing.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. We've had so many different evolutions of our company over time. We started making the crochet bags. And before that, Mauricio was working with artisan communities here in Pacasmayo as well with the stone. And we focused on the bags for a while, but we had one client, which is not a good idea, but it was keeping, we had so much work at the time, but it allowed me to shift my focus down to this business here in Peru. We were full. We were producing 2000 things a season sometimes and 300 artisans and this whole infrastructure we had never built before. So it kept us pretty full, but we hit a wall at one point where the dynamic we had set up with this brand stopped working. It worked for a while and then stopped working because it just wasn't making financial sense for them. I remember first panicking and then second sitting down with Mauricio and really reimagining how are we going to do this then? Like we have to reconsider. We can still do it all, but the container has just shifted. We have to reorganize now, like the same content within a different shape of container, or maybe it's smaller now or whatever. And we did. And I think, like, in hindsight, I would tell my younger self to trust that we're able to be agile and respond to changes pretty quickly and to trust in that as opposed to worrying. What good does worrying do?
It sounded like the single partnership was the Achilles heel in a sense. And it seems like from there you've... Yeah. Shifted to a very diversified portfolio of relationships.
Yeah, I think that moment where we were working with just one client and we had a wake-up call of, oh, this could reach an end and then where would we be? That definitely woke us up and inspired that we would launch the Stone brand a year or two later. And we also expanded a bit of our search for textile clients to diversify what we were doing. It was a hard moment, but it woke us up to changes that we needed to make so that we could make sure to protect everything that we're building and to make it grow to maintain that passion and what we're doing.
Yeah, resilient.
I'm curious a little bit about that. So how do you market the products? How do you get them into where we found them? Your reach, how did you find the places in the market where people can go and transact with you?
We've developed fairly organically. We are not in a major city like New York, where we have this big network of people. I have a number of different friends and stores like Michelle Varian's store that is how I found you guys on this podcast. Her store that used to be in Soho was one of my favorite places to pop into when I lived in New York. And I've always had a list of dream stores I'd love to work with, but that's one thing versus actually building up a network and the right contacts of the people. And we first started showing our line at Shop Object in New York, and we would set up our little booth and then traipse around a little bit after the show to go see the different boutiques that we would hope to be in. And it did grow organically. We launched in February 2019, so just about a year before the pandemic. Thankfully, because it was barely, but just enough time to build our network to a minimum baseline, which then we kept building on over the years during the pandemic. We were able to get into some great accounts like Nordstrom and with MoMA and some of these big retailers that we've been very excited to have those opportunities. But yeah, it's not been easy developing that marketing strategy because we're not marketers, we're designers and we're based in Peru.
I think being a designer and believing so much in what you're doing makes you the perfect marketer. You're not marketing, you're telling a story that you're so passionate
it's true,
about.
And
I
yeah.
think that sells more than selling, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yeah. I hear you because there's so much noise out there to beat the algorithm or whatever. You have to be telling a story that's genuine and that's worthwhile. And if it feels someone's selling to you, it doesn't feel like you care. So yeah, you're right. To some extent, it is valuable that we are behind the storytelling for sure. As also designers and then running a social enterprise, it's a lot to juggle.
Yeah, it is.
I think you're bringing design thinking to the whole business, right? In addition to the products, design thinking mm-hmm. can be applied to raising capital, to relationship nurturing, to sales, marketing, all of that design thinking applies. So I think you're more equipped mm-hmm. than you might realize.
Right, because design thinking is creative problem solving, right?
Yeah.
Like in a nutshell, it's, okay, you have a problem. It's X, Y, or Z. Let me solve it with what I have available to solve it with. And let me listen
yeah.
so that way I can better meet you. And I mm-hmm. think that we started this conversation with you saying that you go into these communities and work with these artisans and you listen first. And that, again, mm-hmm. is that design thinking where you creatively problem solve. You and Mauricio have this vision for how this preservation is so important. And I asked this question earlier, but we didn't really get that answer. I want to dig a little deeper into the why. Why are you so passionate about this thing? And what's that fire about?
Yeah, especially because I know there are moments where the journey's not easy. And so you have to remember why. I know for both Mauricio and myself, we're both very passionate about design. And also on my side, having worked in cultural communication, creating a design language has mm-hmm. been a really rewarding experience for me, being able to translate a design from someone in the UK into, and this is even when I didn't speak Spanish or really embarrassing Spanish, but into a map where I had to realize over and over until I realized, oh, giving the information like this is useless and that they haven't moved forward because I'm not giving them the information the way they need. So let me find the right tools to communicate, because mm-hmm. if you find a common language and you can understand each other, otherwise I'm just talking at them and
yes.
we're not going anywhere. So finding these connecting moments where we're really pulling people on board with us and we share that glimmer that you mentioned is just so rewarding. I think that fuels a lot of what we do, going through the business and creating the financial infrastructure that we need, the marketing campaigns. These are all things that we need to do, but the thing that brings us joy is definitely when we sit down and think through these problems so that we can really connect the dots between the design problem and then this talented community that's looking for solutions.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your name? Because I think it's so unique and actually beautiful when you look at the utilitarian piece of it. Desarrollo Artesanal Rentable Proyectos. Tell
yeah.
us how you yeah. came up with that, what it stands for, and I think it speaks to your why. So I do want to break that down because I was honestly fascinated when I got your email and I'm like, oh, what is this? I did not know what to expect. And then it all came together.
Yeah, and it is ironic because we believe in the long term, but our company is called Desarrollo Artesanal Rentable, which is profitable artisanal development is what it translates to. And so it's what I've mentioned, it's important for us to create the economic path for artisans to have future for their craft techniques. It's not just about the cultural tradition and it's not just about making design. These things all have to be married together. We wanted this umbrella type of company where we can be working with different types of material and technique and capture them under the umbrella of DAR. And then a bonus little fact is that in Spanish, the word DAR is to give, which also plays beautifully into the relationship that we've been working on building.
I love that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And going to how we can reach you. You have this community being cultivated in Peru, but we really can interact mm-hmm. with your products around the world, from New York to California to Japan to Denmark. But what really caught my eye is that you have this presence in museums. And to me, when you explore a museum store, it feels like it's a discovery journey in itself, aside from the museum that you just went So in MoMA in New York, the Fine Arts Museum in Houston, and the Fry Museum in Seattle, I want to hear a little bit about your why and that retail experience. To me, that's the best retail experience I've ever had, museum stores and discovering and joy. What is your thinking around that?
I think that the museum visitor is someone also who's curious about the world, who's asking questions, who's informing themselves. So they are the perfect person that will appreciate a gemstone object that's handmade, that's like maybe even geometric and architectural or what have you. It's just been a really natural fit with museums, to be honest. We've had just so many different wonderful museum partners approach us to carry the line. And MoMA approaches in you and you say yes. It was such a dream for us that came to life. And that's been on our goal list from even before we launched the brand. We showed a little exhibition of stone product in New York, I remember, in 2017, 2 years before we launched. And MoMA came and saw us and we were like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. And they were on our radar from day zero. And when they finally came home and placed an order, we were so excited. So I think it's just a natural fit with the audience that's attending a museum. You know, it's curious people.
Yeah, I love that. Hungry for knowledge and discovery. Yeah.
And that totally can appreciate beauty. That's really the person that you want, is somebody who not only is seeking or wants to be a sponge, but also they want to hold on to something beautiful and experience it every day. That anchor that's deeper than a transaction.
Yeah, these things are meant to be things that you gift to someone, that you keep forever, that you pan down. They're gemstones. They're meant to be honored.
Yeah, they're held stories, which I think our sons now will have this. That's how I see it, is this. Yeah. He's going to hold a story that I get to pass down to him, which I love. We talked a bit about that museum guest. Is there a certain psychology in your consumer, who you're trying to reach, as you said, marketing? Do you think about that at all? What is your philosophy around that?
Well, when we first launched the Stone Line, it was definitely a collection of the things that we love. And everything was very iconic and all the things that we just really love. It has definitely evolved over time as we realized, okay, maybe we should consider things that are more sculptural for this type of client who wants something beautiful for their home, not that's something a bit bigger, that they want to leave out on display, but that has like a twist, a little trick. And recently we've expanded into a few new categories. So the home decor, like the puzzle piece cutting board that you have, pieces that are playful for home, that are imaginative, that maybe have an interaction. Like we have a candelabra that is a triangle puzzle and you can twist and turn it around 40 different ways and make it a candelabra or make it just a game. And it's, we've tried to bring that sense of playfulness into the new things that we're building, but we're definitely trying to expand our market so that we can reach more people and include a few things that are also a bit more accessible, slightly lower price point, so that not every gemstone object that you can buy is $100. We want to have things that are a bit more affordable. We have some things that are wellness tools. Our instinct is to start with what we love, our most playful sense. We're trying to find that nice smooth balance of assortment.
Speaking of things that you love, I'm going to swap the conversation a little bit from all about business, Jenny, and into you as a consumer as well. We like to make sure that people know that it's not just about business, but that there's real humans behind these stories. One of the questions we like to ask is, how do you start your morning? But I'm actually not interested in how you start your morning. I'm interested in how you end I'm interested in how you end your day.
Oh,
I don't know why, but that's
probably because she has a 3-year-old.
I know. I'm like, the morning is a total shenanigan. Like, I already know, but I would love to hear about how you return to you at the end of the day, if that's part of your repertoire, like what that looks like.
It's funny because I'm such a night owl that morning routines have never been my forte necessarily. And recently my daughter is going to a version of senior kindergarten here. And so she's up early and now I'm up early and I'm actually exercising after she goes to class.
Nice.
And it's just groundbreaking for me. I've never had that freedom. But my evenings, to be honest, I do tend to utilize the quiet time when everyone's gone to bed and do some of the thinking that I may not have time for during the day. So I do tend to spend a bit of time in the evening doing some work. And then before bed, I have a nice leisurely little routine of foliate, et cetera, that I try to draw out and enjoy as long as possible because it's just a nice, peaceful slow down. And I also read a book before bed to just decompress my brain and slow it down. And
what are you reading right now?
Yeah,
I'd like to know. What's on your nightstand? What are you reading?
I'm rereading a book called Kafka on the Shore.
Is it Haruki Murakami?
Yeah.
He's my favorite author. So you've got excellent taste. Yeah. This is a little deep dive into Wendy. My favorite author is F. Scott Fitzgerald. The reason why I was introduced to Haruki Murakami was because Haruki Murakami started translating all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's work into Japanese. And that's how he learned English. And that's how his writing style was developed. So I started reading Haruki and I was like, oh, dang, I'm obsessed. And so I went on this deep dive. What I talk about when I talk about running, because he's a runner and I'm a runner. And so anyways, I'm just like, oh, if I ever meet this man, I will turn into a puddle. Like I'll turn into a literal puddle. He's like said something. I don't get starstruck. I really don't have any ego. Yeah. I can meet the president of the United States and I'll be like,
whatever.
Exactly. But if it was Haruki Murakami, I'd just be like, puddle. He's brilliant.
I wish that you meet him. Yeah. I wish that puddle moment for you.
For manifest.
I want to have lunch and share a glass of wine. And I think that would be a really lovely way to die.
Okay. And going to you as a consumer, we've talked a little bit about your market and your audience, but putting yourself in the audience, how do you shop? What's your most ultimate splurge? And what's your most recent favorite purchase that you've had?
My ultimate splurge these days, it's things that give me time, quiet time. That is my splurge, is just investing in time to myself or quality time with friends, time off from work. And the most recent splurge, one of the last things I bought that I really loved was there's a brand called Third Ritual. It's a really beautiful brand. And they make these apothecary scents, these creams that are just another world. And they really transport you and change your mood. And I really enjoy them.
Oh, beautiful. It sounds like you like to carve out space for you because you probably don't get that very organically. So you're very intentional finding Jenny time and Jenny moments to give to yourself.
I think
totally. It requires intention.
Yeah. I think as a small business owner or as a large business owner, there's a way in which we constantly are giving to the business, to the people who work the business, to all of these different things that we love doing, right? It's a passion that fills us in a way, but it can still be really exhausting. Like just because we love doing it doesn't mean, right, that we can't or don't require rest as well. And then layer on top, mom of young child. Yeah. And I'm only 2 years older and it does get easier. I will say Norma came over to my house this weekend and she was like, it's amazing how easy he is. And I'm like, one, he's always been easy, but two, once they get to this certain age, they start wanting to be on their own a little bit more and requiring that space. And so I don't get in his way and he isn't getting my way. And we sat and drank wine and it was lovely.
Not Izzy. Not the 5 year old.
No, Izzy was
Wendy and I.
Very happy on his own coloring and then iPad. He was just like keeping me updated. He's like, mom, I got to go potty. And I'm like, okay, you never have to tell me you need to go potty, but cool kid, you do you.
Yeah. Good luck with that kid. You got it.
But yeah, it does get easier. Being intentional about carving out that time in these years it's brilliant. That's good work that you're doing because it's going to save you that burnout, which I'm sure you've probably experienced as well.
Totally. It's a balance that I struggle with at times for sure.
And not to plug our other episode, but I feel like you need to listen to the Camp Chateau episode it was such an eye-opener on taking time to understand who you are in a summer camp for women in the southwest of France. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Jenny should come to France with us.
Episode 8.
I think you'll just appreciate her incredible journey. Anyway, so she founded a camp in the southwest of France for the purpose of just being with yourself. Because I'm in that stage of motherhood where it's not survival mode anymore. And I think you're probably in the same place because my son was born a month before yours. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm finally able to exhale a little bit. Wendy and I are going together. And I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, Jenny needs to join us there. It's time. Anyway, so listen to episode 8.
I absolutely will. I can't wait.
I do hope we're okay on time. I just want to wrap up with, I'm inspired by your journey, your courage, the age that you were to travel the world and learn and understand, to me, is something that I wish I had at an earlier age. And I think more young people should feel, if that was a dream to follow, that it's possible. So I appreciate the beginning of your journey of saying I was curious and I was hungry for knowledge, and that travel, especially as a woman alone, to me would feel very intimidating. But I think that's informed so much of this brand and who you are and finding your partner in Mauricio, and so many people that might be listening that might feel intimidated to take that step.
Yeah, because I think the reason why we feel intimidated is because we hear all the stories of women not doing it well. It is holding women back from actually experiencing the world that's available to us because we're told that it's not safe for us to do it. And I think that more stories of women taking life as it's promised to all of us, whether you're man or woman, and doing it is what we need to hear more of.
Thank you. I haven't really thought about that time period in a while, and it's true. It was, you know, I think that's something any a man or woman, it makes no difference. You have to have that wherewithal, I think, and just have that spidey sense of follow your intuition. And I remember friends, meeting people, talking to people and saying like, oh, you're going this way? Okay, let's go together. I'm not putting myself in a tricky situation, but more just having companionship throughout the journey that allowed me to be together with people when I felt that I should be. And then also have independence. Coming to Peru, working with my partner, it was such a serendipitous time that we, I think, met each other and we're both in a moment where that made sense for us to end up together. I hadn't met the right person for a very long time, and it just so happened to all come together in this serendipitous moment. So I think being open to what the world presents was the key.
And trust your heart. I love that. You listened to your heart and you trusted it. And that's incredible. Good for you. We're proud of you.
You got two cheerleaders over here.
Amazing.
Yeah. So tell us what's next. Look a little bit further out. So 5 years out, where do you want to take that proyectos? And help us understand, if someone's listening out there, how they can transact with you. Where can they find you around the world? There's obviously so many stores, museum stores, places where they can interact with your products. How would you want that transaction to happen?
We don't have an e-com site on our website. We sell only through our partners, although we do have an exciting launch coming up in late April.
This episode to come out about that time, because I think we will.
So, yeah. We don't directly sell. We sell through all these great retail partners, and that's something definitely we want to grow. And we're expanding right now into other regions. We're starting to work with an organization in Dubai. We're growing in Japan. We're doing lots of cool things to open up new markets. So in 5 years from now, I imagine that that's all just running smoothly, and we're focusing on building cool new design objects to continue expanding the collection with these thoughtful objects. We're looking at maybe we make some bigger, more elaborate designs, but we have to find the pathway in the market for those to make sense first. But yeah, we're in a phase of growth, so in 5 years from now, we'll have, I think, reached a point where things fall into a nice balance and are running seamlessly. We're doing a Kickstarter campaign, which is the first time we've ever sold directly to our consumers. So we're exposing our market to everything that we're doing, and also sharing our certification with Nest that we received. And then we're also going to launch a new product that we're really excited about. So we're trying a different path of expanding our marketing efforts, and I think it's going to be very cool.
That's very smart. I'm very excited about that.
What is your personal favorite product from your collection?
Oh, no. Ooh, you're asking
her. I know you like all your babies. Wow. But you love all your babies, but one of them is your favorite. Let's be honest.
Or one of them took a lot of work to come out just right.
That's a really tricky one. On the stones, my instinct is that it's our cube. We have a gemstone cube that has 7 different colors of gemstones, and it fits perfectly together. And you can solve it many different ways, but you can also make little animal shapes and things. And it's the classic.
You know what? It reminds me of Rubik's Cube. I loved that piece as well. Yeah.
It's called a Soma Cube. Been around for centuries. It's not a new design, but it's something that is just so much fun to play with when it's made in gemstones. Beautiful. That's a big one. And then on the textile, I'll add one more, that we started making a stretchy yarn last year, sorry, 2 years ago. And it's this yarn that's the cord of the masks that we wore all pandemic. Mm-hmm. But it's thinner and it's stretchy and it's colorful, any color that we want. And we've been weaving bikinis with those and coming up with just the right balance of stretchiness and wearability. We started making bags and accessories, but now we're making garments, and that's so deeply satisfying for me as a fashion designer and someone who's always made my clothes. I'm like, oh, finally, here we go.
I'm going to weave this back into the earlier part of the conversation. I think it's so important to hear what you've done with a fashion degree. I've had friends that went to fashion school and did so many different things that aren't necessarily what you would expect. So I think if you're a fashion student and you're listening in, look at this incredible brand that is diverse, right? In terms of how you're expressing that knowledge and bringing in this love of fabric and weaving fabric.
Social fabric. In fashion design, there are many big fashion houses in big cities, but they're not all cool to work at. They're not all even doing design. You're maybe just copying things that someone else has done. But that's not what you learn in design school, at the very least. And design school doesn't really prepare us for the real world of working in the design business. Like I said, production is a non-existent conversation in design school, which is absurd. And so I've done a little bit of teaching since design school and been able to do seminars with students, especially in fashion design and textiles, about think through what does it mean to launch a brand, and not only a brand, besides the brand, what does it mean to launch a company, and how are you going to produce it, and how are you going to cost it, and what does that mean for your target consumer? Can they afford it, or is it just this artistic piece that you've dreamed up that's wonderful, but it's one-off and you won't make it again? Thinking about it as a business from multiple points of view, it's so important for students to have more awareness, because you blindly go to design school thinking like, oh, cool, I'm going to be the next whatever designer. But unless you have a lot of money to enable that, you have to work for someone else. It's good to work for someone else because there's a lot more to the business than simply design.
I love that. This was incredibly inspiring, and I'm actually really hoping that we're going to see you in France this summer. I'm hoping we'll convince you to travel there.
This summer,
Yes, in episode 8. That's your homework after this.
We'll send you the link, don't worry.
Please do. I'm seriously, I have a group of girlfriends, and that sounds like the dream trip of a lifetime for a group of friends at some point, or solo even.
Everything. Philippa described the experience as one where you can come totally by yourself, but you will leave with a whole cohort of new lifetime friends.
Thank you so much, Jenny. And please send our love to Mauricio. He was very much a part of this story.
We realized that we sometimes stayed a bit into the background of our own story. Yeah, we're also likewise thinking about ways that we share more of us.
Good.
And if you're ever in the San Francisco Bay Area, you have now have a second home there.
Yeah.
We would love to host you for a glass of wine.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yes.
Such so a much. Pleasure speaking with you both.
And we'll be in touch soon.
This is Wendy and Norma. We love hearing from you, your comments, your likes, your stars, all of the things really resonate with us. So tell us what's working for you so we can continue to deliver that magic. This is Wendy and Norma inviting you to transact with love.